Bob and I were talking last night how we both feel at tables and things set the guys doing the workshop apart from the rest of us. And never have liked the idea of that. So that was our reason for requesting two things. One, that we get in the circle, and the other, we get rid of the table. The problem with that is I can't put my feet up and take a nap. Anybody going through something like this for the first time here? Wow.
Really?
Great. Great. Let me pick up on one of you. Kind of over there. If you, what were you kind of hoping to get out of it?
Yeah.
How long have you been
here?
Wonderful. Well, what we're going to do, I think, is probably just kind of share our experience, what's happened to us with the steps and the big book and that. I think you'll find some cases we're a little bit open-minded, and if it's getting away from stuff from the book Alcoholics Anonymous, our minds don't slam shut, but they start creaking shut. I have had some experience that I tried, and I got sicker as I was doing it by staying outside of the big book. And so that's my experience. And based on that, I don't want to share things that didn't work for me. And so that's a big part about my attitude. I think I'm past the place of being too critical of people who don't use the big book. Particularly if there's a microphone around. That's kind of pretty much it for me. So, Kenny, you want to comment before you start? Or you can go ahead and start.
Well, my experience is that if you continue to seek a spiritual experience, you'll continue to have them. It's only when you figure you've reached nirvana or whatever point you've decided is the end that things start coming apart. I frankly don't want to spend the rest of my life living in a lie. And so I'm going to do everything I can to get as close to the truth as I can while I'm still breathing. So that's why I go through the work on a regular basis. Other than the fact that in the book it says that a business that takes no regular inventory is sure to fail. I think that there is some real virtue in doing all of these things on a regular basis. If it's your first time, you're probably going to have an experience. And the real truth about it is, no matter how you feel after going through the steps again, you have had another experience, some of them pretty big. One of the most enlightening experiences I had was when I was 28 years sober and went through the steps again. And all of a sudden, lights started going on, and I didn't think there were any more lights to go on. And all of a sudden, there were legions of lights that went on at once. And I had a real spiritual experience at that point. So I continue to do that, and God can present you with whatever He wants at whatever time He wants. But the only vehicle that I know to get closer to God is these 12 steps. And the whole damn thing's counterintuitive. I mean, we're not people who would be introspective. we're people that just try to brush off the world and keep going and, you know, just push our way through it. And the real truth is that periodic contemplation about who and what we are is a really valuable tool in growing spiritually. And using the 12 steps is probably the best vehicle that I've ever found for doing that. And there may be others, I don't know. But I know that these work for me. And I've gone through the steps and felt like nothing happened. Well, I've done it a whole bunch of times, about once a year for all the years I've been sober. And I just felt like, well, when is the light gonna? When's the flash? When's the lightning bolt? When's the deal? And it didn't feel like it happened. But every time I take a look at this stuff, my mind changes. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, this is really about changing your mind. This is about being open enough to know that you don't believe that you know everything there is to know. And having some real desire to become the person that God intended you to be. And I can't, as an act of the will, become that. I can't say, okay, God, I'm going to be who you want me to be now. Because that just doesn't work for me. You know, I think it requires work, which is something that we all rebel against. And this is part of that whole process. And Gary and I have both been doing this regularly for a long time and have had our own experiences of going through the steps on a regular basis and what's happened. And the net result of that is I'm sure Gary is the same, but that we've changed significantly. One of the things that's become apparent to me is that when I came into this program, I wouldn't have known a spiritual principle if it fell on me. And I didn't have any spiritual principles. And over these years, by going back through this process, I've developed this set of spiritual principles that I live by as closely as I can, and certainly not perfectly. But what happens over time by going through this process is that we will develop a whole set of spiritual principles that become the guideposts in our lives. And we just start deciding things like this is all right and that isn't. And we find out how life works. One of the promises in the book is that we can face life successfully. And that was a big problem for me. And now it's less of a problem. You know, life's still a challenge. I was probably bitching all the way up the mountain here about my day on Friday. But life's a challenge, and then we go deal with it. And what we usually find out is what we think is a real mountain to climb is nothing more than a pebble to step over. So we're going to talk about steps and our experience with the steps. And the first one, obviously, there's six sessions. I suppose what we'll try and do is cover a couple of steps in each session. And the first one, my experience with the first step is this. I come from a family of alcoholics where people just regularly died from alcoholism. I never expected to live past 30. By the time I was in my mid-20s, I was a chronic alcoholic. And I'm not sure I even fought it. It just looked like everybody else in my family. And I thought, well, All right, I'm another alcoholic. I'm just, you know, from, that's what happens to people in my family. And I'm going to die from this, so I might as well get as comfortable as I can and try and get as much as I can, as quick as I can. And if I die when I'm 30 or 35, then that's the way it is. And so, at least from my way of thinking, I had a pretty good grip on the first step before I ever showed up at Alcoholics Anonymous. It was just part of the whole family thing that I came from. So I knew I was an alcoholic. I knew my life was unmanageable. And I didn't really think there was anything to do about it. And until I really was close to death from alcoholism, I didn't really try that hard to do anything about it. The book says we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we're like other people, or presently maybe, which means there ever will be, has to be smashed. Well, I knew there were people like me that drank like I did, but most people didn't. And I knew I was different. I just didn't know there was anything to do about it. Even when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm looking at that and going, well, these guys seem to be doing something to stop drinking, but I don't think that'll work for me. And I just thought I'd come in there and get a bunch of buddies, and then I thought I was going to die pretty quickly anyway. So I think and some people have a problem with trying to figure out whether they're alcoholic or not. I didn't. I knew it. I mean, I knew that right down to the bottom of my existence that I was alcoholic. There are some ways to figure out if you're alcoholic. In the book it says, if when you honestly want to, you find you can't quit entirely. And that means that you try to quit, and it doesn't work. Quitting entirely means stop now, don't ever start again. And somebody saying that to me was ridiculous. I couldn't quit. I couldn't even slow down. Or if once you start, you have little control over the amount you take, which means that if you went out to have two drinks and you came back on Thursday, it says then you're probably alcoholic. The bad news is that if you're an alcoholic, you may suffer from a disease which only a spiritual experience can conquer. I hated that because it means I was left out. I had no more idea of how to have a spiritual experience than I did about jumping over the moon. It didn't compute. Somebody said, you're going to have a spiritual experience. I'd go start digging the grave. I don't know how to do that. There's a couple other things. One of them is the phenomenon of craving. When I work with people, I ask them, that's one of the first questions I ask them. I say, here's what craving is. When you take a drink, you have to have another one. Tell me about your experience with that. And if I can't get a clear answer of the experience with craving, I'm really reluctant to work with people. And the reason why is because they aren't like I am. Jesus, when I took a drink, it was like bar the door. I mean, I'd set all sorts of things in motions and none of it was good. So part of the book says that the phenomenon of craving only occurs in alcoholics. The other one is, and this one gets a little trickier because some people won't cop to it, and that is losing the power of choice in drink. My experience with drinking is that for the last probably 10 to 15 years that I drank, and I did, that means everywhere from my early 20s, that when I got up in the morning, I knew I had to drink. That there really wasn't a choice. And I was asking this priest about it one time that was helping me get sober, and I said, what the hell is that anyway? And he said, that's your body getting used to all that alcohol, and then it starts sending you signals until your mind reacts to it. And your body starts demanding that you put more alcohol in there. And it'll make up all kinds of excuses, or your mind will make up all kinds of excuses to take the drink you don't want to take. And you know, whether it's well, it's my birthday, or it's like Independence Day in the Aleutian Islands, you know, as long as there's some even mildly plausible reason to take a drink, you will. So losing the power of choice in drink means you're going to drink. And I spent a lot of years experiencing precisely that. Getting up in the morning and asking myself, how far can I get through this day without taking a drink and getting so drunk I mess up the rest of the day. So one of the things you may want to ask yourself is, what's that got to do with me? Did those things happen in my life? The other thing that I'll just mention at this point is you know, for years we'd say, well, you're the only one that can say you're an alcoholic. That's not exactly true. If I'm going to work with you, I better damn well know you're an alcoholic, or I won't work with you. You know, if you're having some sort of emotional trauma and decide that you're an alcoholic because you had three glasses of wine instead of two, see, I don't get it. I'm a nasty-ass chronic alcoholic who couldn't stop, who got up every day for almost 15 years and had to take a drink. So I had a lady in a workshop I was doing she's a therapist, and she said, you can't tell me if I'm alcoholic. And I said, if I'm working with you, I can. And she said, well, that just isn't right. And I said, well, great. She got in a big huff and wanted to leave. And she started telling me about how she was alcoholic, and I told her that was really nice of her to explain that to me, but if she came to me and asked me for help, I probably wouldn't work with her because she didn't sound like a drunk to me. At some point, we have to make those choices. And, you know, not to be a hard ass or, you know, overly opinionated, which I am. I got to tell you, I think this is a nasty-ass, rotten disease. I think there's nothing humorous about alcoholism. I think that it kills thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands of good people, good, bright, productive people, and that it's a deadly serious deal when you start trying to figure out whether you're alcoholic. You better take a good look. because if you're not alcoholic, you're trying to have a spiritual experience based on a lie. And that's a contradiction in terms. So that's what I think.
I wish you'd just go out and say it. I mean, why are you pussyfooting around? Didn't quite have that same experience. I had to get dried out to kind of realize what was going on. It just hadn't entered my mind. I had completely forgotten about the time I was taken to the emergency room. And severe alcoholic withdrawal. Apparently it irritated my bride, and the doctor wasn't real happy with me, and the nurse had a big wrinkle right down there. He said, well, we're going to give him a big shot of this stuff, and you're going to have to hurry to get him home so he can get to bed before he goes out. Julie kind of had a relieved look on her face, and that nurse thoroughly enjoyed hitting me in the ass with that 8-penny nail to give me that shot. And I went home, and the time we got home, Julie got out of the car, I got behind the driver's seat, I went downtown, showed up a couple of days later. I'd forgotten about that. That didn't seem alcoholic to me. Those things just hadn't registered. I just would blow on by. I had a wonderful knack for going into bars. Got to be a damn cool. There's a week-long celebration in Cheyenne they call Frontier Day. The rodeo is now 7 days long and all that. Back then, downtown Cheyenne was a party. At Mayflower Bar on one side, 18th to 17th Street, and on the north side, and the south side, there's a Valencia Bar. And about two-thirds through the night, the Valencia drunks would be standing out in the street throwing beer bottles across the street at the guys at the Mayflower Bar. And that was just the style of things for the longest time. And I just thought it was wonderful. And one time I was in the wrong bar. And I came out of there, and there was some dude there, and he had a pink shirt on with, what do you call it, the stuff that hangs down on buckskin and that sort of
fringes.
Thing. Fringes hanging down on buckskin and all that, and he seemed to resent what I said about anybody who would wear a shirt like that. And so we decided we were going to go out in the alley, and I kind of sized him up. So I went out the door first, and as he's coming out the door, I start to punch him. I spun around as hard. I've never hit anybody as hard in my life. I hit him with everything I have, and I got to tell you, it really pissed him off. Shortly after that, people are running to find Julie and tell her, don't panic when you see Gary. Because there wasn't a spot on my face from my eyes down that wasn't black and blue or broken. And I just took a hell of a beating. And that was one of several. But I never saw that as a big alcoholic either. I know some non-alcoholics that want to fight. I just got in the fight. I didn't know you're supposed to win them again. All this stuff that went on, it was just accoutrements, if you will, to the alcoholism. I didn't catch on that this all had everything to do with no choice. The bad checks I would write in the bars to drink. I didn't have money, but I had to drink. And so I'd write a bad check to get the drink. Wasn't too much of a problem, except I didn't have an account anymore. That got tricky. But it kind of went on. And so when I got dried out in that hospital and we discussed it, the doctor's opinion. That was me. If I take a drink, I'm going to drink. That is it. And if I take one drink, I'm going to drink, but it may not be that day. I may not take that second drink for a day or two, but I'm going to take it. And when I took it with gusto. So I didn't recognize the craving at that point. But for some reason, I could tough it out sometimes a day or two before the second drink hit me. And all that. Maybe that was a con. I don't remember. Man, I can't be an alcoholic. I took that drink. Hell, I didn't drink again till Tuesday. Whatever it was. It just took me a while to kind of see all this. Pretty dense. After I was out of the meth house and we're doing this stuff and we're looking about the same thing we're talking about here with the first step, identifying whether we would sometimes tell somebody we don't think they had enough to drink, they need to go back out with that, and following what we got to call the test in the book. You know, go out and try the drinks, especially. Try it more at once. Yeah, well, we got to follow on the Marty Mann test. Anybody in here familiar with the Marty Mann test? Marty Mann was the first woman to come in and stay sober. And she irritated most of the men in AA doing it. And it turned out to be a really good thing for her. Her test was that what you need to do is go out and take one drink a day for 30 days. No more, no less. And she says, if you can do that, you're just, by golly, not an alcoholic. Yeah, anybody in here think they can do that? Anybody think they want to try it? Huh? It doesn't matter.
Results are the same.
It doesn't matter. And I remember sitting thinking about that the first time I heard that and all that. And that was just completely ridiculous that I would even consider that I could do that. But I've met people that could try. There was a guy that showed up at my home group in Indianapolis that had 8 years sobriety. Big book guy. He could quote the big book better than I can yet. He was coming to the meetings for a while, and then you can't see him hit and miss. Called me one night, and he said, Gary, I'm going to go out and take a test. I said, really? And I said, you're convinced you must need to. He said, yeah, I really think I need to. I'm not sure I'm an alcoholic. He said, what are you going to say? Go ahead. And he called me back about 3 or 4 weeks later. It wasn't long. And I said, how'd the test go? And he said, well, you know those three restaurants I owned? Back when the hot wings thing was getting hot out there. Said, yeah. I said, I'm down to one. And it's probably going to go this week. He said, I've stolen all my parents' retirement and all that, and I just can't get enough to drink. And I says, well, I said, most people that have stuck around as long as you did and decided to take the test, generally flunk it. I've never seen anybody get that. He says, all I wanted was a D. And I don't know if he ever got that. Last I heard, he was working for Arthur Anderson in Houston on the Enron cases. Now you know what happened. The first step for me made more sense to me, actually, after I had fully conceded to my inner self, completed the work in the third chapter. And began looking on page 52 at the bedevilments with that, because you can think you've got a pretty well first step and you really got your life coming together, and all of a sudden ask yourself what the bedevilments are. That was the biggest thing I could do for me. And that's still where I'll start. If one of the bedevilments is out of whack, I'll figure it's time for me to go through the book again, go through the steps again. And they still get out of whack. I'd like to say on occasion, but I don't know if I can even honestly say that, because I find myself in 10-step situations pretty regularly. Being convinced that I'm an alcoholic was the key thing for me, and I wish I'd have caught it faster. I wish it would have lit up and booked me, because I wasted a lot of time screwing around looking at easier, softer ways with this thing. Hazelden guide and the 12 and 12, and try to make up my own program thing you could say to me in a meeting back then.
Just take whatever you want and leave you with.
I got 5 years of taking the wrong shit. I can't be trusted to leave that kind of decision to. I mean, I just can't do it. You got anything else I want?
We used to hear in our meeting people would say, well, in my program.
Yeah.
And every time they did that, someone would pipe up and say, what do you call your program? We call ours Alcoholics Anonymous. Normally, and I'm sure not in every case, but normally, people who said, well, in my program, were making up their own. Let me interject one other thing. If you want to say something, or if you want to ask a question, or if you want to do anything, we're not going to have some specific time for that. Okay? So all you got to do is either start talking or raise your hand or do something. Yeah. Yeah. No married women. Oh, Jesus. You want to get something shoved up your backside. Let's see. Always give people more than what they want. Be as straightforward. I have a reputation for being a little too candid. And you have to watch out with that, because that can almost become a form of abuse. But I think that telling people the truth, even if it's hard for them to hear or other people start thinking you're a jerk for telling them, is still a necessary part of the process. And having the courage of your convictions. If you see someone dying in front of you from alcoholism and you don't say anything, you're just as culpable as they are. And see, most people don't want to do that because they're so damn busy protecting their ego, they won't say anything. And if you can bring some truth into someone's life at a critical moment, and you don't do it, you lost a chance to help save them from their condition. And so, do you have enough courage to speak up when everybody else in the room is going to make some sort of judgment about you for being crass, being a jerk about how you approach things? I can give you an example of that. I was at a meeting called Dragon's Den. And this woman, she kept coming in and out. She was... She's always drunk or coming down or something. And she was the same way when she came into this one. I'd seen her around for 4 or 5 years. And she'd always come in and she'd get all cramped up, you know, like this. And people would huddle around her and go, it's all going to be all right, honey. And just keep coming back and keep the plug in the jug and bring the mind and the body will follow, or whatever the hell that thing is. And Jesus, what a load of crap. And I'm watching them doing this, and see, that wasn't my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. My experience was I was told what to do, and it was, there's the bar and there's the deal. So pick one. And I just... So it went around the room, and it got around to me, and I said... I only want to say one thing, and the person I want to address it to is that lady over there with her head stuck up her ass. Jesus, it polarized the whole meeting. And I said, you've been coming in and out for 5 years. You come in here so people stroke you, and then you go out and drink again. You're just taking up space in this meeting because you have no intention of getting sober. So why the hell do you even come to Alcoholics Anonymous? Oh, God. You would have thought I shot the Pope. I got a really icy reception. I mean, nobody wanted to talk to me after me. I didn't see that lady again for a while, maybe a year, and she showed up in the same meeting about a year later, and she came up to me afterwards, and she said, you remember about a year ago when I came into the meeting and I was coming down off a bed drunk and all those people were surrounding me? And I said, yeah. And she said, you're the only one I heard. It was pretty hard to miss. And she said, I put myself in a treatment center the next day and I've been sober ever since. Well, I'll take a lot of abuse if I can reach someone, even if I have to bark at them. And I don't care, you know, what other people say about you're an asshole or why do you do stuff like that. And it's not something you do regularly, but every once in a while, if your intuition tells you that you really need to interrupt someone's thought process, then you have to ask yourself a question. You have the courage to do that. And so, you know, some of the principles have to do with what are you willing to stand for? Do you have the courage of your convictions? Will you say something when no one else will? Those are the kind of principles that you come to live by. Unfortunately, there are a whole bunch of other principles that we come to live by which are self-defeating. And when we get to inventory, we'll talk about that. But once you get into Alcoholics Anonymous and you seek a spiritual solution, you start building this repertoire of spiritual principles that you choose to live by. And your life changes. And that, you know, I was in a meeting the other day and I said, new people coming into Alcoholics Anonymous at the very best have some sort of passing acquaintance with spiritual principles. Which is an excellent, compelling reason why you shouldn't have a relationship with a newcomer. They don't know what the hell they want. You know, they're just looking around trying to survive. But they didn't come in, they're not going to have a life based on principles when they show up at the door. And so their principles are going to change significantly, and it's going to leave you in the dirt, probably. So I'm not saying you shouldn't be nice to new people. I'm just saying having an intimate relationship with a newcomer is like testing a knife blade on your throat. Probably not a good idea. So there's another opinion. And you don't have to take opinions seriously. Does that answer the question?
I think there... Longer there, I don't want to spend much time on it. We need to kind of keep going before we got 20 minutes to do the second step. I've been asking myself a lot lately, and it's probably just due to the time difference in my life and that sort of thing. But I'd be thinking over things in my life that I've been talking about for years. Then I've been asking myself, did that really happen? And do it prayerfully, and asking myself if that really happened, if I can't clearly say yes, it leaves my story gone. I'm not talking about it. I'm not bringing it back up. I don't remember it. It must not have been that important. This wasn't my own idea. There's a guy named Sandy out in the circuit that I listen to a lot. And I think he's wonderful. He mentioned doing that. But when I started doing that, I got to looking at the thing I would do, like Bob talked about, if I heard something stupid in the meeting or saw something like the lady you were just discussing or that sort of thing. And I had to ask myself there, was I doing that? This is a long time. This part isn't. Am I doing that to show off in the meeting, or am I doing it trying to really help that person with that? And I couldn't answer that clearly. I did not have a clear answer for that. So that's when I went and I'd go up to the person after the meeting and call him and do that. And two guys quickly. The important thing is to tell them the truth. There was some woman running around York Street years ago, and she says, I think a lover is somebody that will tell you the truth and not care whether you like them or not. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember who it was, but probably someone I shouldn't have been talking to. One guy was a guy that kept coming back in, kept coming back in, kept coming back in. And he was getting the pats on the back, just like you're talking about. And after the meeting, he was just kind of standing there, and I kind of muscled myself in the conversation. And all I said to him was, why don't you just quit doing it? Why don't you go out? I said, this has got to be driving me nuts. The guilt you're going through, you're going to AA, and then you're finding yourself drunk before you get home. That's just got to be destroying you. Quit doing it. If you got to go out and drink, quit coming to AA. Don't come back. Don't do it till you get a belly. And I was, you know, I was not looked at fondly by anybody else in there for a long time. And saw him again in a different meeting somewhere else sometime later, a few months later. He said in the meeting, he said, the guy that helped me most in AA was Gary, and he told me not to come back till I stopped drinking. He got it a little bit out of whack from what I was saying, but he was thanking me for that. When he came back, he was done. He's still sober. And I don't know what he does. He doesn't hang with me or any of my guys. But I did that with him. And another one was a fellow that was kind of doing the same thing. This, it was a different kind of a guy. The second guy was a guy that had a lot of money. So he had all sorts of people coming around him to help him. So I cornered him after a meeting, and I just called him on his first step, because he said something goofy, and I said, you don't have a fucking clue what the first step is, but what are you doing with it? And it just stunned him. Nobody had talked to him that way to get his attention. After I left, he turned around to my friend Mike, and he says, what the hell's the matter with Gary? And he said, he just told you the truth. If you don't like it, he gave you just enough ammo there to make him number one on your resentment list. But you're going to have to hurry if you want him up there on the top spot. And it works. So living by principles, I think, need to continually be looked at. Because one day I may have it and the next day I may not. And a lot of that is intuition, isn't it? A lot of that's God saying, you better go straighten that puppy out. I've been tending AA there for quite a while at that point, and with all this stuff going on in First Step. I remember sitting in the Sunday Night Young People's Meeting, and people would share there. It was a speaker meeting, but in Denver then, we would have three speakers get up and talk in our meeting. And people were getting up that I'd watched change, getting up and talking. They'd come in after I had been there and successfully had a start in the steps, and their lives were straightening out. And they were getting, guys were getting caught up on their child support, holding jobs, and getting cleaned up at the court, and doing all that stuff. And I was sitting watching and listening to them. And they I finally got the gist of what most of them were sorrowing of, that they had invited God into their lives, and these changes were due to that. And I the quotes were that, you know, I took a second step or something like that. But I hadn't really got it in that point until I heard these people getting their gear together, and like I said that night, they were blaming it on God. And it struck me that God was working in their lives, and they were at least as screwed up as I was. He was probably a little worse, but their lives were getting straight out, and there must be a God. And I hadn't had any experience with that yet, other than that. And so I was coming to believe by watching Alcoholics Get Sober in AA. And I don't know any other way to put that. I had no other thing to base it on. And so when it came time to start reading in the fourth chapter, it made more sense to me this time than when I went through it, and I didn't have to graduate. I'm not so sure that the second step is something I took. I think it's something that happened to me as a result of everything else I was doing in AA. You better have a God out there if you got a first step, because that's no place to be without a God. There better be one. And I think that had something to do with it. There just kind of happened to be a time in there, and we were reading in the fourth chapter, and the time we got to the fifth and all that, I was convinced there was a God. I had discovered something else. The craziest thing I did, the biggest insanity I did it when I wasn't drinking. The craziest thing I did as an alcoholic, I did it stone sober. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. Take the first drink. There was a few times in there where maybe I went a week, 10 days, 2 weeks, and hadn't had a drink. You know, the dog's coming back into the kitchen with me. And either back in the big bed or closer. And the life would be going fine. And actually collected a paycheck. All that stuff going on. And then for no reason, I'd take a drink. There was no defense to me having that drink, and I don't know what the opportunity was. It was just crazy. I'd find myself drinking with that and say, how did it happen? So, they talk about beating your head on the bar, and I don't remember that I did that, but I remember sitting at the bar and thinking, I've done it again. Of course, your next thought is, well, fuck it. I just as well go ahead and tie it on now. But, I don't really have anything philosophical to say about the second step. It was just about that simple. It happened to me, and I think it happened to me as a result of the first step more than anything else.
Go ahead. I have a question.
Okay.
The second half of the first step is about power and the final kingdom. We all have agreed that we can't handle alcohol. I had difficulty making decisions in my life when I wasn't drinking.
I got more answers than that as a result of the bedevilments in the fourth chapter. Bedevilments kind of seemed to separate themselves from the first step by moving to the fourth chapter from the third. But I can remember sitting looking at those while we were doing all that, and I could answer every one of those. I was having trouble with my personal relationship. You know? I was a prey to misery and depression. I couldn't control my emotions. I couldn't make money. I was unhappy. It was useless to other people. And I've got them out of order. I don't have them memorized. All that was going on in my life. And those particular signs of unmanageability were the biggest, signs, I guess. Omens that my life is completely unmanageable. I caught on to that too earlier, that I carried all that emotion for a long time with me after I'd stopped drinking. I heard Jack Brennan years ago, he used to talk about the hole in the belly with the wind blowing through. And that described what I felt going on exactly. And I remember one time as a kid telling my dad I was afraid And he says, "Ah, shit, what do you got to be scared of?" And I never told him it again until a long time sober. There's a lot of times it was clear I should have been afraid, but I wasn't. But if you wanted some clear idea of where our life is unmanageable, just take a hard look at the bedevilment, because that will show up. But I couldn't manage my life to the point that I could manage the fear of it. Didn't know to pray. You know, I'm a big, grown up, healthy guy. I shouldn't be afraid. Why? Just go away, fear. It didn't work for me. I couldn't manage that. And if I was living by the fear, then I was always making the wrong decision. Anytime I'm making decisions based on feelings, I'm not managing my life. Feelings aren't fact. Feelings are real. But they're generally there, and we're so used to following our feelings that I was doing whatever I could to feel good. I thought it was going to make me feel better. I tried it, thinking that was managing my life. And it's not. Any thoughts on that?
People come into Alcoholics Anonymous confused and unable to make decisions for fear that they're going to make a mistake. So as a consequence, we just don't make them in the hope that whatever we're trying to decide goes away. The biggest help as you get sober is going to be your intuition. It'll tell you which way to go. And the ability to make decisions after that becomes a simpler matter. Bud talks about growing intuition, that it becomes a working part of the mind. We come to rely on it. And all of a sudden, if there's another thing that's counterintuitive, and it's that part of the book of it that says we relax and take it easy, we don't struggle. If we learn to do that, we can learn to make reasonable decisions. One of the things that we believe for some reason is that the next decision we make is going to be the last one, that it's going to be, you know, that it's going to influence the rest of our lives, and that we'll never ever change our mind and all that stuff. It's just bullshit. Okay, if you make a decision and it doesn't work out right, make another one. And we don't get to that unless we come in and start working on it. There's a couple of things I'd like to say about the second step. One of them is it says if we're even willing to believe. And see, I didn't want to believe because I thought if there was a God, he was probably mad, and that meant that I was going to have to suffer some consequences. And so I was hoping that really didn't have much to do with what was going on. And my sponsor asked me one day when I was like 90 days sober, "How come you're not drinking?" And I said, "I don't know." And he said, "Well, I mean, you drank a fifth a day for all these years, and now you're not drinking. What the hell happened?" And I said, "I don't know. Why do you keep asking me the same question?" And he said, "Well, did you change your diet?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Are you exercising?" And I said, "No." And he said, "You going to work every day?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, what's different?" And he said, "Are you praying?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Why are you doing that?" And I said, "Because you told me to." And he said, "Do you believe in God?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Would you concede that you're sober today by the grace of a God you don't even believe in?" It's an interesting question. I mean, even for someone that had as muddled a mind as I had. And I had to start considering the idea that maybe God had intervened in my life and did something miraculous, which meant I got up one day and I didn't have to drink. Gary was talking about the bedevilments. Actually, there's a counterpoint to the bedevilments, and that the bedevilments talk about people that can't seem to be a real help to others, that are afraid of misery and depression, all that stuff. And then it talks about people over here that have power, peace, happiness, and a sense of group. And it says that the difference is that God is the central fact in those lives where people have power, peace, happiness, and a sense of direction. So you have to ask yourself, which one of those do you want to live with? And then it talks about being crushed by a self-imposed crisis. We could neither postpone nor invade. The self-imposed crisis is not alcoholism. The self-imposed crisis is that I can't fix myself. That I'm suffering from a degenerative and fatal disease. And I can't stop it. I can't even slow it down. And it said we had to fearlessly face the proposition that God either is or he isn't. He's either everything or he's nothing. What's your choice to be? So I have to make a choice there about whether God is or he isn't, whether he's everything or he's nothing. Now that seems kind of strange, because if God is, then by its very definition, he's everything. And if he's everything, that means everything. And am I willing to believe that? You know what really brings most of us to this is desperation. You know, I don't want to believe that. I want to believe in self-sufficiency. That's what I want to believe in. And self-sufficiency damn near killed me. And I still want to believe it. And the whole idea, when I was brought up with all this Jack Armstrong bullshit, and, you know, being a superhero and all that, and all of a sudden I have to say, I can't do this, I can't handle this, God, if you don't intervene in my life, the game's over for me. Turning to that kind of a statement is beyond the pale for me. That's not some place where I would go. But necessity will take me there. It says, the old expression is it necessity is the mother of invention? At some point, when I see that my whole life is dependent, based on my previous experience, my whole life is dependent upon some God that's loving and gracious, I'll have almost no choice but to turn to that. And so that's where I turn, and that's how I came to believe, by somebody asking me why I was sober. That was my second step experience. There was nothing else that I could lay that off on, except praying to something I didn't believe in. And so I used to go fishing out on Lake Winnebago in Wisconsin. It was 471 square mile, like great big thing. And it was real shallow, so if you got out there in a storm, it ripped the bottom of your boat out. This priest that ran the halfway house, and I used to go fishing out there, and he'd say, "So, Bob, what do you think about God?" And I'd say, "Well, I'm trying not to." And he'd say, "Well, you want to let him into your life?" And I'd say, "You know, I got some real problems with that." And he said, "Well, watch how your life changes. And watch to see if there are answers to your prayers. And see what happens. See if you have to take a drink. Try and figure out why that's different today." And I came to believe over time. It was really a sort of an educational, spiritual experience. And I came to believe because there was no other choice for me.
Real quick, Bob and I have a friend who talks about being willing to become willing. Sneaking up on it, I guess. We need to take about a 15-minute break about now.